The state is following up on tips that have come in after it offered a $5,000 reward for information about a mass killing of baby hammerhead sharks. Jason Raduya is the deputy chief of the Department of Land and Natural Resources Division of Conservation Enforcement Union. He has more on the discovery of close to 100 shark pups in the Kehi Harbor area.
You know, we are receiving some calls where people are providing information. But right now, they haven't developed into any real investigative leads at this point.
Okay, so you really need the public's kokua on this one.
We really do, because we have a theory of what we think may have occurred, where these hammerhead pups were likely taken by a gill net. What we'd like to do is try to confirm that theory and try to get an idea of the identity of the persons who may have been involved. And that's really why we need to get information from the public.
Explain to our listeners the dangers of those nets.
Well, you know, gill nets are a type of fishing gear that does not discriminate, meaning that once it's placed into the water, it pretty much kills everything. And so this is particularly the reason why it's so important that people who fish with gill nets follow the state's fishing regulations, which means that if you're using it in the lay net fishing method, you must inspect your net 2 hours after the initial set, and you must remove the net 4 hours after the initial set. Now, the inspection of the net is really important, because that's where fishermen need to take a look at what's caught and remove any unwanted catch and any catch that is undersized or whose take would be in violation of the state fishing regulations.
And this case was really tragic, because we're talking a lot of shark pups.
That is correct. So while the hammerhead shark pups themselves are not a illegal species to take, the quantity of the sharks is very devastating to the species as far as the number that was taken. These sharks were very small. They were infant, and they are now unable to reach reproductive size where they would replenish themselves and reproduce and continue to be a viable species. And so, the take of this many sharks at that particular size and age was really unnecessary.
What was the exact count?
I don't have that information specifically, but I believe it was somewhere in the area of 75 to 100.
And what can you share with us about the behavior of hammerhead sharks? I mean, don't they normally come in closer to shore in order to give birth?
That's true, and it is the pupping season right now, and so areas like Kehi Lagoon are common areas where hammerheads come in and pretty much go through the pupping process and give birth to hammerhead shark pups in those types of waters. And so, you know, it's important for fishermen to understand this so that when they use their fishing gear, they're aware of the type of ramifications and consequences of its use.
Now, I've seen hammerhead sharks in Kaneohe Bay, but I imagine that, yeah, across the island chain, you've got this, you know, happening everywhere since it's the season.
That's true. It's common all over the state. Hammerheads, as a species, they'll go into these nearshore areas to pup, and you know, fishermen need to understand what's happening with a lot of things when they go and fish, and particularly the regulated species, and basically just have an understanding that their actions are really affecting our nearshore ecosystems.
And what can you tell us about maybe the size of the nets that you normally see out in use?
Well, for a lay net type of fishing net, a gill net used in a lay net fishing method, typically the eye size legally has to be no less than 2 3/4 inches when you stretch the eye mesh. Anything less than that is illegal in size and cannot be used. And if our officers find it, we will seize those nets and we will issue the appropriate citations for them. So really, the stretched eye measure is very important. It has to be of legal size. But, you know, gill nets used across the state is one of the most regulated pieces of fishing gear. And it's regulated by the method of use, as well as time, location, and size restrictions. And so people have to understand that if you're going to use a gill net for fishing, you really have to be aware of all of these regulations that pertain to its use.
And really be responsible and check them often.
Correct. You know, if you're going to use a gill net, it's very important that the fishermen inspect the net. Again, these nets tend to kill, and they don't discriminate. And so really the only way to get proper control and know what you're taking is to inspect the net for the catch and to remove anything that's unwanted or illegal.
You folks have been able to prosecute violators. I think maybe folks have actually called in tips, or maybe your staff has actually come across these nets out there illegally.
Yes, gill net enforcement is one of the highest priorities of our department's many responsibilities. We have made numerous cases on fishermen who have violated the gill net rules. We have seized many nets. We have seized many boats that are used in the commission of these crimes, as well as other pieces of evidence. And we have been very successful in court. The courts are recognizing the importance of strong enforcement and strong deterrence for these types of violations. And, you know, gill net enforcement is a very high priority for us.
You've been with the DLNR for what, more than a decade and a half. I mean, how would you characterize this case? Is this one of the worst you've seen?
You know, it is probably the worst I've seen when it comes to hammerhead shark pups. Really taking a large quantity like it was in this incident was very unnecessary. If the fishermen were following the state's fishing regulations and exercising pono fishing practices, which really means that they're using legal fishing gear, that they're practicing conservation and ethically minded fishing practices, and heeding the state's fishing regulations, the death of these hammerhead pups would likely have been avoided.
And you really need the public's help, because you folks cover a wide area and are understaffed in a lot of cases. So you really rely on the public to help call in tips or alert you to problems.
That's very true. You know, for Doe Care, we have officers across the state, but we can't be everywhere at every time. And it's really important that we seek the help of the public, especially in cases like these where we're trying to understand what happened and who the responsibles might be. And so we really look to the public for their information and to come forward and to try to help us, because, you know, we're all living on this island and our natural resources are very finite. And so we all need to work together to protect our natural resources and especially our aquatic resources.
And there is a hotline that people can call in to report violators, correct?
Yes, there is. The statewide enforcement hotline is 643-DLNR. People can call that number and remain anonymous and provide whatever information they have. We have the capability to respond pretty much at all hours of the day and night. And while we're not a true 24/7 law enforcement agency, we do have the capacity to spin up responses very quickly if necessary.
That was DLNR's Deputy Enforcement Chief Jason Reduya talking about the use of gill nets, which may have been the reason why so many hammerhead shark pups were killed recently.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a homeless advocate tackles the so-called sit-lie ban. But first, your quiz.
In a previous backyard quiz, we asked listeners to name the real-life inspiration behind the famed fictional detective, Charlie Chan. Apana Chang was the man's name, and he was every bit as interesting as the character that novelist Earl Dare Biggers based off of him. Born Aping Chang in Waipio in 1873, Chang served 34 years in the Honolulu Police Department, first as an officer and later as a detective. His exploits as a beat cop were the stuff of legends, and his prolific police work was a scourge of opium dens and floating crap games. An attack from a sickle-wielding assailant left Chang with a distinctive scar over his right eye, which makes the fact that he went on patrol armed only with a bullwhip all the more impressive. This unorthodox sidearm, however, was a relic for his previous occupation as a paniolo. For today's backyard quiz, what prominent family did Apana Chang work for as a cattleman? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar, Hawaii Pacific University, and Locations.
Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, expressing growing frustration with Oahu's homeless problem, is asking the City Council to approve a practice he had previously vetoed, the so-called sit-lie ban, with two bills that would expand that practice island-wide. Alani Apio is a homeless advocate and community organizer who says continually moving people off the street can only make a bad situation worse.
The criminalization of homelessness, which is what the euphemism of compassionate disruption ultimately is incredibly dehumanizing and crushing to individuals and communities. And ultimately, it's like brutal punishment for people simply because, for whatever reason, they don't have the ability to have a home like we do. And, I think in a context of, like, does child abuse work? Does corporal punishment at the deeper, if one slap doesn't get a kid, moving along, will five slaps do it? It's like, no, that is patently untrue, doesn't work. And it's the same thing that's happening here.
Well, Alani, it's not presented as a slap. It's presented as an opportunity to help people get back on their feet. Shouldn't that be, doesn't that sound like a pretty benign motivation?
It sounds like it. And on the surface, that's why the public is buying it. But what I have found is that our shelter system is deeply flawed, and frankly, I think it's broken. It was built at a time, it got built up at a time when there was a modicum of affordable housing that people could potentially get into. But we're in a state now, literally and figuratively, in 2018, where we have thousands of people on the streets, in the bushes, on Oahu. And if we put every one of them into a shelter space that's available, two things. One, there still would be thousands out there. And two, we don't have an inventory of affordable, truly affordable housing that they can move into from those shelters. And so we have a deeply broken system where the government has incentivized these shelters to pull people through and get as many people through the system as possible. But if there isn't housing at the end of their stay, and they're all transitory, there's always an end to the stay, then we just simply throw them back out on the streets again. And frankly, a lot of my friends that I've met, they are done with the shelter system because they end up losing more and hurting more by going into them if there isn't housing at the end of it.
How, losing more how, Alani?
So for example, if you're on the streets, you have to build, the best way for you to survive is to build community. And at a deep level, we are all looking for community to belong to. So you go out on the streets and you start trying to make friends, and those friends become your extended family, the people that will help you watch you through the night. And those situations can develop deep bonds between people. Now, then, so for example, my friends out in Kaka'ako, they have communities, they have friends. And then recently Mother Waldron Park was closed, and I helped move five of the friends that I made down in there, because I have a truck, into various shelters when the city, via the mayor, swept and closed Mother Waldron Park. They're all five already back out on the streets less than 2 months later. And what happens is one of them went into one of the shelters. I took her there. She had two large suitcases, a small bag. When she got there, a couple days later, she called me and she said, Alani, I can't stay here. They won't allow me to keep my things. They told me I have too much. I have to get rid of stuff. But this is all that I have in my life. This is all my clothes, all the things that I need. If I lose this, I'm going to start from zero again when I end the shelter stay. So she voluntarily came out of the shelter so that she could keep her things. That's just one example. And then when she got out, she told me she had bed bugs. So there were bed bugs there, and she has bed bug bites now. So, and then when she got back out on the street, when she went back to where she was, all of her friends are scattered. So now she's a female alone on the streets again with less than she started with.
We've seen familiar patterns in an attempt to address homelessness, houselessness in Hawaii, and it seems as if we're on repetitive cycles. Does it seem that way to you?
Oh, absolutely. I interviewed one woman out in Waianae, and she put it this way. If I had a house and I was sweeping up dust, I sweep it all into a pile. It's in a pile. And then I sweep it into another room. And then I sweep it into another room. But I'm continually trying to tell myself that I'm cleaning the house. You would think that I'm crazy. That's exactly what we're doing. We're sweeping people from one place to another, trying to convince ourselves it's an election year, people are angry, people want something done. We keep sweeping human beings from one place to another and try to convince ourselves that that's the right thing to do. Well, and what it's actually doing is pushing people more and more into despair, making it harder, actually, for us to actually help them.
Alani, let's just hypothesize that you were given the power and the resources to address houselessness. What would you do?
One of the first things that I do, and that we've tried to do, my friends and I, is try to reconnect those who are houseless with those who are housed in our feelings about them, literally rehumanize them. Because I think the media and the government have done an astounding job at dehumanizing, and not everybody and not all the time, but the language we use, the attitudes that we take, that we somehow, that we, by being brutal to people, that's going to bring them along. I want people to know is like, these are your friends and neighbors. They could be your uncle. They could be your hairdresser. They could be your mother. They could be your sons. The people that are out there that are struggling, they're just you and me. I think we have to decide that the biggest thing people need is safety and security and a way to help themselves build themselves back up vis-a-vis community. So what I'm talking about is Ohana Zones. I think that we really need to
to experiment with them. We may not get it right the first time or times, but what people crave is belonging and community. When I'm talking about creating an ohana zone, I'm talking about creating housing at ideally $10,000 or less per unit. Now, that's going to be for those who really have no money, or what, you know, in my work on with the houseless, $200 to $300 a month is about max that they could afford on a monthly basis. If you're struggling and fall to the point where you can't afford anything more than $200 to $300, you're going to have a very basic unit, simply like walls around you in a camp-like situation, maybe a bathroom in your unit, most likely not. So I don't think we're going to be competing, because I don't think that people who have even an apartment that is, you know, low income are going to look at that and say, well, I want to live there.
Alani Apio is an artist, writer, and homeless advocate and community organizer. To listen back to this story or any other segments of the show, you can visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Cybersecurity is a relatively new issue in state and national elections, but it's growing with each election cycle. The head of the Office of Elections Voter Services section calls it a changing threat landscape, and the federal government is giving the state of Hawaii money to deal with it. The story is in today's Honolulu Civil Beat, and editor Patty Epler is on the line with today's reality check. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning, Chris.
I love that euphemism, changing threat landscape, don't you?
It is changing, though, right, with all the cybersecurity issues and everything. So
it is changing, and sometimes when you look at cybersecurity, you wonder if the hackers aren't sort of outdistancing the regulators.
I think that's absolutely the case. And so it's great that the federal government is giving Hawaii $3.1 million to try and keep up with it a little bit through some hiring some experts, getting some new equipment, and doing some better staff training.
Is that how the money is going to break down, staff and specific hires of maybe hackers for the good guys?
That's right. That's what we're being told, at least, and that's what they've applied for in a you know, application submitted to the feds. I think the cybersecurity experts will be probably one of the big keys to it. You know, Hawaii hasn't had, at least as far as we know, much problem with hacking. We've had things like running short of ballots, as you'll remember, or, you know, the polls not really functioning as well as they should. But I don't think they've had too much problem yet with the actual electronic environment.
And, you know, when solutions are suggested for electronic voting, it's funny because we seem to go back to very, you know, paper ballots and very old school ways of doing things.
Yeah, that's true, too. That is true, too. But at least we weren't one of the 12 states or so that were that really had a problem with it, with the Russian security threat this year. And you never know what's going to happen when we go to if we go to all mail-in voting in the future, as, you know, Kauai is going to be trying out soon.
Yeah. Well, Patty, those in those 12 states, they didn't really find out that there was a problem until well after the election, did they? Or did they?
I think there were some experts that were sort of suspicious that things were going on, but I think, you know, you're right that most of it came out well after the election.
That's a troubling thing. It's kind of still kind of a hazy, changing threat landscape, isn't it?
It is definitely. And, you know, I'm the last person to know anything at all about computers. I can, like, turn mine on and make it work, and that's kind of about it, you know. But I think it is a really good move for the state to have taken advantage of this federal money and try and you know, beef up a little bit in advance, you know, so that hopefully then we won't find out after the fact that there was a real problem.
Fingers crossed, Patty.
I hope so, although it'll make great stories when it does happen.
That's true. Low-hanging fruit, right? Thanks a lot.
Exactly. Thank you, Chris.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat editor Patty Epler with today's Reality Check. And to read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director, and he's here to give us a preview of what's to come next week. Hi, Bill.
Aloha, Catherine. So, you know, one focus that a lot of the news just worldwide is looking at right now is these trade tensions between the United States and China. And a lot of the focus when people think about retaliation of what China might do, it's, oh, the soybean farmers in Iowa and the makers of Kentucky bourbon. And that's all true. But it's not really safe to assume that Hawaii is not going to be involved in this at all. And there is, in the run-up to this, in terms of earlier discussions about what may or may not happen, a couple of senior Chinese officials very, very quietly sort of alluded to the idea that tourism is a growing service industry for the United States and for Chinese tourists, and that that might be an area where they could apply extra taxes, extra charges for people coming from China to the United States, and they may even refine it to certain destinations within the United States. Now, again, this was talk. This was at the, you know, in preliminary sort of discussions, and the Chinese have been playing it very close to the vest in terms of exactly what they're going to target and to what extent. But the idea that Hawaii might be impacted potentially about that, something that's worth a closer look.
I was just reading something about how the expectation of the flood of Chinese investment and tourists coming in is not as rapid as people thought.
No, exactly. Hawaii Business has good, actually, piece on that. And there's a little sort of over-enthusiasm with the idea of, oh, goodness, the Chinese will just come in. Chinese travel is a very different situation than what Hawaii is set up for with Japanese tourists, and the assumption that, oh, we can just sort of, you know, make a parallel construction has not quite been the case. Also, the idea of investment in real estate is an area to watch in terms of what the United States does. If the United States restricts Chinese investment in the United States, there could be a spill-on impact on that as well.
Okay. Anything else fun down the road?
Ooh, so here's one thing this afternoon on All Things Considered. Mental Health Kōkua group does a lot of important work in the community. Greg Payton's a great guy heading that up. They have started on Maui a coffee shop that's started by people who've had mental health and housing issues, and they're providing jobs and a future and hope. And Greg's going to be talking about that on Helping Hand with Dave Lawrence later this afternoon on All Things Considered.
Okay.
Worth a listen.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill Dorman, HPR's news director.
You bet.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
July, but it's been quite a year so far. A false missile alert, a flash flood on two islands, and neighborhoods consumed by lava. And we're just in the early part of hurricane season. Tonight, Hawaii emergency management officials will be in Maui for an open house meeting. They're winding up a series of meetings to get feedback on a draft plan to help us make us more resilient as a state in the event of a natural disaster. We spoke with Haima's David Kennard about this latest effort.
The state multi-hazard mitigation plan is the framework for the state to look at ways of reducing the impact of natural hazards on the state of Hawaii. So we focus primarily on things like earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, flooding events, so natural hazards. And we do an analysis of the impact of those hazards on the built environment in Hawaii. We call it a risk assessment, so the risk being the impact of the natural hazards. And then once we kind of evaluate the risks and think about ways of addressing those risks, minimizing the impacts, we develop a strategy for doing that. So collect up different kinds of actions, projects that can make the state more resilient and more able to withstand the impact of a natural hazard event.
I know at the hearings, one of the things that was brought out was that many of our utilities were located in the inundation zones, and there, you know, concerns about how do we deal with that issue.
Well, you know, utilities and lots of our infrastructure in Hawaii, unfortunately, are you know, we build on the coast, and so they're in relatively high risk areas from flooding, and also the high wind impacts. So there's a range of things that we can do that go from, you know, doing things to harden those facilities to make them more likely to withstand the flooding by flood-proofing structures or maybe elevating the structures or the critical portions of those structures. Another more longer-term approach is to, you know, move those potentially affected facilities away from the hazards. So, you know, people talk about different approaches, you know, managed retreat away from the highest areas, you know, relocating a little further away from the places where the impacts are the greatest.
So where are we with this report?
So we just completed our initial draft update. We're soliciting input from our stakeholders and from the public. It's one reason why we're having these open houses is to both let people know that we're doing this plan update, but also to ask if they have ideas about mitigation actions, potential projects, you know, public education, outreach, things that we might to make us better prepared in the future and make us a more resilient community.
In your assessment, what's the biggest change?
I think the biggest change is, there are a couple. You know, one of the biggest changes is the increased awareness of the impacts of climate change. You know, climates have been changing a lot over the years, and there are things that we've been able to identify over the last 2 years in terms of increasing the sea levels, also shifts in the weather patterns that lead to areas of greater drought or more drastic drought and or greater rainfalls. So incorporating that information is a big element. I think there's also been an increased awareness on the things that we can do through strengthening our building codes. And there's been I think, big strides in protecting our communities, the general public, and our infrastructure by building smarter and stronger in the future. So I think those are the two big impacts that we've seen over our current review.
Now, we did have a major flooding incident just in June, which took everybody by surprise because it wasn't really a storm. And we were shocked at some of the areas that were impacted.
Right. And I think that, we're one of the things that we're really interested in is trying to get a better handle on how those climate change related effects are going to happen. We're working with folks, the National Weather Service, at the University of Hawaii, to try and get a sense of, how should we expect more commonly those, severe rain events like we had on Kauai just a little while ago, where there was, unexpectedly 48 inches of rain within a 24-hour period. So how likely are those things going to happen again in the future, and what can we do to protect ourselves against the type of flooding that results from it? So that's a big part of what we're hoping to do in the future as a result of our planning efforts.
Right, and I know Honolulu's mayor had raised the question about homes that were along some of the streams. And the question is, what do you do? Do you then condemn homes along those areas?
Always the wisest choice is to move away from the hazard. That's not always possible. People can elevate in some instances so that they're above what the expected flooding will be. And then in other instances, there are things that you can do to floodproof your structure. So, moving utilities up, if you can't move the whole building up, at least, the electrical, the air conditioning, some of those things you can get up off of the floodplain so that the impact of the damage is not so great. But we will be continuing to accept comments from the folks through the middle of July. And then I also mentioned that, the mitigation plan is, to use the cliche, it's a living document. It's, we continue to review it and update it over the five-year cycle that we're in. So if people have comments even after the middle of July, by all means, they should forward them to us, and we'll include them in our annual review as we go forward.
Okay, but this is really top of mind. We're just, like I said, coming off the unexpected floods from June. We're dealing with the volcano and lots of earthquakes over on the Big Island. So really, this is the time for input.
Yes, very much so. And unfortunately, there are not a lot of options for dealing with lava flows to mitigate the impacts. But, if people have ideas about that, please, by all means, they should give them to us.
That was Haima's David Kenner talking about a proposed risk assessment plan for natural hazards that the state's trying to get public input on. If you've not been able to attend the open houses that were held on various islands this week, you can still give input online. To find links to the draft plan, go to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we told you that legendary Honolulu Police Detective Chang Apana was acknowledged by novelist Earl Derbiggers as the inspiration for his fictional sleuth, Charlie Chan. Between 1898 and 1932, Chang patrolled the mean streets of Honolulu's Chinatown, back when the area was known as Blood Town, or Hell's Half Acre. Before he joined the force, however, he rode as a paniolo for one of Hawaii's most prominent families. That family, as we asked our listeners to tell us, was none other than the Wilders. Chang was specifically in the employ of Helen Kinau Wilder, known today as the founder of the Hawaii Humane Society. While Chang's career as a paniolo may have been brief, a little piece of his ranch hand days stayed with him during his police career in the form of the bullwhip he carried during his patrols. Sadly, no one got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, committed to accelerating literacy and learning for students throughout the state, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Winding up in France this week, festivities marking the 25th anniversary of the first hula halau in Paris. Kumu Kilohanasil founded the group while living in Europe, and halau hula o manoa continues to thrive. A group of her dancers from Honolulu traveled to Europe this summer along with her sister halau, Halau Mele, and their kumu, Mahelani Wong. Both troupes paid homage to their teachers, Kumu John Keola Lake and Ellen Castillo, in the dances and chants they performed, sharing aloha with Parisianers. I was fortunate to travel with them in a nod to Hawaiian history and culture, beckoning back to a time when Hawaii's ali'i made the first French connection. This trip was about rekindling ties and then some. La Vie en Rose, a Paris classic, but this version includes a slacky guitar and ukulele. Such is the transformation, thanks to a halau in Paris. Kilohana Silve pays homage to her teachers as she marks this anniversary.
Yes, this is what the festival is all about, paying respects to the source of any knowledge we may have and are able to share. Modest as it is, it's... Exciting to think that here in Paris, this interest in Hawaiian culture has grown, and we're sharing it today, 25 years after our first little workshop gathering.
And the halau all came about because a little girl, part Hawaiian, part French, wanted to learn more about hula.
My daughter wanted to learn hula, and that's how I started teaching hula in Paris because of her desire, but I wanted it to be as authentic as possible. And the people that were there in the beginning, many of them, 25 years later, they are still there, even though some have hurt their knees or their back. They can't dance with us, but they're still very much a part of the halau.
Students from Halau Hula o Manoa came from as far away as Italy and Alaska. They gathered to mark the anniversary and to attend workshops to learn under cultural advisors Chanter Sam Gaughan and Master Weaver Marcus Hanale Marzan.
My name is Elsa Demexa. I'm from Juneau, Alaska. And Kilohana Silve has a school there, amongst other schools around the world. And we have a group that's about... 16 people strong, and we love the Hawaiian culture, and we love learning anything and everything that Kilohana has to share with us. We just think, you know, it's a gift. We love it, and when she has had events in different places, and any opportunity any of us can get, we would fundraise and go. So here we are in Paris. It's wonderful.
Mahealani Wong is the kumu for Halau Mele, whose members are being showcased in this festival.
You know, initially people were saying, oh, why do you go to France, you know, and especially Paris, kind of stuck up, and I thought, wow, that is not the experience I had. And then it opens my eyes more so to the fact that when you go to a place and visit with people and not just on a tour, you realize the importance of maintaining relationships across countries, across cultures, across, you know, language. It's so fulfilling and valuable. And if that connection is made through hula, then for me that works.
Wong sought out flora in a French forest, gathering greenery for their performances, even going so far as to buy fabric in the city and sewing skirts, so the dancers bring a bit of the city back to the islands. Extra effort toward making festival memories.
My grandmother traveled a lot. My grandfather was in the military. She lived in Germany, and she lived in Vietnam and stuff, and she always, it was just part of who they were, being Hawaiian. You know, they had their music. They had the way they approached things, I think. And that made me think about the fact that no matter where we go, we are Hawaiian. We can practice a culture wherever. We use the different plants that we see. Because, of course, we have kinolau that are important to us in hula, that those plants are important. But if you don't have that, you can still make a lei. That lei itself is something very valuable. To look at something and say, wow, we can continue this practice of making lei or making our adornments to perform or to do whatever it is with what we have, that there are some things that we carry with us regardless of where we are. There were just leaves hanging in the parking lot, and so we just picked one and started hipu'u, the tying style. I'm like, this kind of works, you know, we could maybe do this. So I thought for this particular festival, we'll do it for all of our kahiko stuff, and even the ohana stuff. I'm just going to go to the florist. We'll see what's there. We'll make it from there. Kelly'i Raichel was posting. He had a thing where one of his hamana in Japan made a lei, a haku lei, so with a tea leaf backing, out of sakura. So that, too, like, kind of inspirational for me, that here's this lei. It was so traditional to Hawaii and to hula and all the importance of that. But made with flowers, fresh flowers. I wish we could totally get away from using fake stuff. So we try to use fresh stuff as much as possible. And I love the idea of just gathering this and creating something that's Hawaii. And at the same time, the halau, our halau learns how to use different material, right? So that practice, even in the doing it for show, you get ma'a to it, your hands understand different materials, makes you a better lei maker, right? Will make you a better, just more knowledgeable. And then the halau here, if they find they have the opportunity to say, remember when halau mele came and they made this thing out of this? This is how it came out in, you know? So right there, it's not an official workshop, but everybody's learning a little bit more.
Yeah. It becomes one, really.
It does. Sure, sure. We had an unofficial little cocoa workshop in the last thing we were doing because they were just pinning orchids in their hair. And I thought, I've got raffia. Let's whip something up. So I made it, wore it right there for that performance.
Right. So that's what you'll be doing.
I hope it's not, I hope it's not like 10 minutes before the performance, but you never know.
Kilohana Silve says the events are all about planting seeds and watching them thrive and flourish. There's something about adding an island touch, not just choreographing a hula to La Vie en Rose, but singing the Parisian classic in Hawaiian.
Oh.
what you find. That's what you find when you're out and about on the streets of Paris. Over the next few weeks, we'll be featuring stories from the festival in France, and we hope to show you a different dimension of the City of Lights as Hawaii gives it a bit of tropical glow and sparkle.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
What if state lines were drawn based on water districts? I'm John Dankosky on the next Science Friday, how 19th century scientist John Wesley Powell predicted and reimagined the water issues in the western U.S., plus how protecting eagle nests helped the birds bounce back. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we'll look at the future of Hawaii tourism, and we'll be taking your calls.
We'd like to hear from you. Call the Talk Back line. Leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
You can find the music you hear on the show at our playlist on the page, our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finity, and Amber Khan Grusby. Our summer interns are Harrison Patino and Savannah Harriman-Polt.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
I'm Chris Vandergood. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.